Welcome to a special episode of the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast. In this episode, we want to talk about direct criticism of Trainer Road that cited specific studies on polarized training. So what we're going to do now is we're going to go in depth, go into these studies in depth, and there's two main questions that we want to answer. Should Trainer Road's plans be replaced with polarized plans? And then also, are Trainer Road's plans too intense? And this begs the question too, is there even an optimal way to train overall? And we're going to try to answer that as well as somebody can answer that inside of this podcast. So to give you kind of an overview of what we're going to do, first we're going to talk about what polarized training is and how that fits into endurance training. Then we're going to dig deep in the literature about polarized training. And then we're kind of going to talk about how that relates to Trainer Road's plans and our approach here. Before we go any deeper on that, I just want to clarify this point is our interests are totally aligned in terms of Trainer Road's interest is to help you get faster. We stay in business by making cyclists faster. And as far as our brand perception and our core values of we want to constantly improve, if we find something that we think we can change our training philosophy that makes everybody faster, we will totally implement that. And that's actually why we implemented adaptive training, because we believe that will make people faster. And there's some nuance in everyone inside of that. And then also our position is just data led. So based on what data we see, that's what we want to do to change the product and update it to make everyone faster. We're not like hardcore taking a position on one methodology over another. And hopefully as you go through all of this, you'll understand why that is the case.
With the podcast, our job here is we want to do our due diligence to bring you distilled relevant takeaways from the research that can be applied to real life. And we're going to try to do that today. The other thing is we want to empower you to critically assess what you encounter on the internet, whether that's in popular media or even, as we'll see today, in the research itself.
Now, kind of on the side note here, as CEO, when you run a business, the best thing you can do is get the right people into the right chairs to like, and have them be on the bus to kind of make it a better product. And what I want to do, and what this is my goal all the time, is to hire the right people to get everyone the right training solutions. One of my, probably, I think, Amber, you are my proudest hire to date. And hopefully we can improve that someday and there's someone to be more proud of. But as of now, no one, sorry, all the employees,
restate
but that. Amber's special. No, we can just go with that. Everyone's proud of you, Amber. So Amber has both the World Tour professional cycling, and also she has a science background. So can we just take a second, Amber, and we don't get to hear a lot about your science background. Can you please state that?
Yeah. This is a part of my life that doesn't come up a lot in cycling circles. So it's kind of fun to get a chance to talk about it. But in college, I earned my bachelor's in human biology. And then I went on to earn my master's of science. And both of those degrees came from Stanford University while I was there. And during that time, the work and the research that I did between my undergraduate and my graduate degrees resulted in two peer-reviewed publications. And one of those I actually published as first author. And something I'm mentioning only because when peer-reviewed journal articles go to print, the first author is generally the person who's done the lion's share of the work. And in that case, I'm proud of the fact that that was a study where I really dug in there and was formulating the original question, designing the experiments, gathering the data, analyzing the data, and then ending up doing the lion's share of the writing as well. So those are two things I'm actually really, really proud of from that background.
But you also have a background of evaluating and editing research papers professionally. Is that correct?
Yeah. So after I graduated, I was racing professionally, but I didn't really want to totally walk away from that world because I found a really nice sense of balance with that. So I always kept one foot in the academic realm. So for the first 2 years that I was racing professionally, I was actually a research assistant for the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy and Research. And then when I moved overseas to Europe to race full time, I started freelancing as a technical editor for academic research papers. And the interesting thing about Europe is that there's a high demand for this because most of the peer-reviewed literature is published in English. And a lot of the European researchers don't speak English necessarily as their native language. They're very, very good at it, but it's really helpful for them and reassuring to have a native English speaker edit their work. And the longer I did this, there was a high demand for it, so I was able to do pretty well with this. But the longer I did this, I actually was able to get in a layer below the English component and actually really dig in because I have this technical background to help evaluate, you know, find holes in the logic, find holes in experimental design, and really help evaluate and make the papers better from a technical perspective as well. So after racing in Europe and developing this kind of freelance side hustle, if you will, when we moved back to the States, my husband got a faculty position at the University of Connecticut. And the School of Engineering at UConn actually hired me as a professional technical writer and editor for the faculty in the School of Engineering. And one of the things that most people don't understand is faculty and academic researchers are very time poor. They have a lot going on. They're trying to get funding, advise students, teach at the same time as managing a lab, doing experiments, getting their publications out the door. And so even though their job is largely the communication and the writing of science, they're often on a learning curve that's just really a painful process of trial and error. So the School of Engineering will hire people like me to come in because this is really what I've been doing for, well, what I had been doing for the better part of a decade, to come in and help them with that and really facilitate this. So I edit and evaluate research and grant proposals for the NSF, the National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health, and the Department of Defense, which are major funding sources here in the U.S., and then I also look at manuscripts for peer-reviewed journal articles, which are those journal articles that are describing studies that have already been done. And I've been doing this across STEM fields. So the bulk of the work that I do is through the biomedical engineering department, but I've also done papers on thruster design in nanosatellites and deep space exploration, additive manufacturing, robotics, material science, designing liquid crystalline gels. And it's really been a lot of fun because it brings a lot of balance to my life.
I'm telling y'all, she's a good hire. Like when you first got on the podcast too, I got like 100 messages literally being like, you should hire Amber. And I'm like, I know. She has to agree to it though. So I'm glad you did, Amber, and I'm glad you're here. Now, one thing that's important that you also have is real world application and translating that into real world performance outcomes, because this is a little side note, but the Science of Getting Faster podcast that we started, that was made because what we saw is that there are people that read the abstract or just the title, and then they run with that into an outcome that does not relate. So the Science of Getting Faster podcast, we talk to the researcher directly and try to figure out what the study suggests and what it doesn't. And really, inside of a study, all studies have limitations, of course, and we can't just extrapolate that out. So you have some real world experience with this. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So it's been really fun because I have this one foot in the realm of academic research in that ivory tower, so to speak. But the other side of this has been, I've been able to see all of these, especially in exercise physiology, see this research applied in real time. So when I was at Stanford, I was actually swimming on scholarship for the Division I women's swimming team. And we actually took part in a lot of cutting edge research. We were part of some of the really, really early studies looking at the effects of core temperature on performance, which is pretty cool to go back and remember that. But then also once I started cycling, I'm old enough that when I started racing professionally, it was the World Cup, but eventually became the World Tour. But once I was racing on the World Tour level, I was also working with world-leading physiologists, performance directors, coaches, and nutritionists, because those folks, they know the research, and their job is to come in at this high level of the sport and really implement those cutting-edge findings and to apply them in real life. And it doesn't translate one-to-one. And so that was a really interesting perspective to be able to have, you know, in real life firsthand, is to see these researchers and exactly, you know, understand the research, but then see how the application happens and how that actually translates from a clinical and a real life perspective.
Now, so again, with the hires, I am proud of Amber, but Amber's not our only superstar. I love all of my employees, and there's so many people that are great. And just for example, I'm thinking on the ML team, we have people with a master's degree in exercise physiology, a whole bunch of degrees in all different areas. Amber is just one of the faces of Trainer Road, so that's why you see her more. But I just want to stress, like, there's a whole commitment to improving this, and it's not just, we have an altruistic way of making the world faster, but also, this is how we make money and this is how we stay in business, right? If we did not do
put
this
food on the table.
Exactly. Like our families depend on this and us doing a good job on that. So I just want to say again, we're aligned with you. Amber, yeah, so go ahead.
I was just going to say my favorite part of working at Trainer Road is feeling like everyone around me is smarter and more dedicated than I am. And I don't mean that in a self-deprecating way. It's actually the most fun way to work because it's so motivating and so inspiring. And I'm constantly learning and being challenged. And it's an awesome environment. And it's an amazing team behind the scenes that's really completely dedicated themselves to helping all of our athletes get faster.
Well, Anna, what I'm excited about, our culture is kind of like exceeded me, where it just like keeps going on without my input and getting better, which is really, if you can work at a place like that, that's awesome. Trainer.com/jobs. We have job openings right now. So Amber, what have you learned from your experience and research for on like the world tour?
Right. So I love this stuff. You can, anybody who knows me, and if you've ever heard me talk on the podcast, you're probably thinking like, yeah, this is obviously a good fit. And I find this work really, really fulfilling. But when I talk about my background, I'm really not trying to position myself as a gatekeeper, because that's not the point of this. The truth is, anyone can learn to read scientific literature really well. But to take it a step further from just reading it to really critically thinking about it and analyzing it takes a lot of skill. It's a skill like anything else. So it requires effort, discipline, and time. But like we always talk about skills on the bike, there's no ceiling to skills. So this is a really fun learning curve to jump on. And anyone, even if you're not an expert in the field, can use your own logic to get in there and critically assess or question what it is that you're reading. And so I really want to emphasize this, because critically analyzing literature, that's really doing science. But if you're just reading it and quoting it, that can really just amount to marketing. So what I really would like to do here is empower those of you listening with a few questions that you can start to ask yourself as you encounter these kinds of studies, whether it's in popular media or if you actually like go to PubMed because you enjoy reading this stuff. Here's four questions that you can ask yourself when you're reading a study. The first question is to figure out what the central aim or question of the study is. And this is really easy to find. It's in the abstract, the introduction, or the discussion. I personally like to find this in the introduction, because that's where the authors will motivate the reason behind why they want to, why they're driving at this particular aim. They'll motivate that gap in knowledge that they're trying to fill, and they'll give you kind of a state of the science to provide some context. The second question you want to ask yourself is, how did the authors decide to answer the central question? And you find this in the methods and the results sections. So these are probably the most boring sections of most papers, but they're really, really important, because you can't interpret the results responsibly if you don't know how they were generated. So when you're reading these sections, you can ask yourself questions like, how did the authors define the terms? Because if they're going to do a physiological study, they have to decide what kind of subjects they want to use. Do they want untrained or trained? Okay, let's say they decide that they want to do a study on trained athletes. Okay, now they have to decide how they're going to define trained athletes, because guess what? There's no standardized definition. So looking into those things can help you identify strengths and weaknesses in the methods. The third question you want to ask yourself is, what are the limitations of the study? Any researcher will tell you most methods have some limitations. And this doesn't mean that the science is bad. It doesn't mean that the researchers are bad. There's just no perfect way of doing this. And nature is really hard to control. So it's impossible sometimes to control for all the factors. So what you want to do is you want to identify what those are. Are there limitations of the methods? Are there some limitations of the analyses? That might be trickier if you're not familiar with the field, but you can still identify where there might be some confounding factors or maybe even alternative explanations. The discussion area is where the authors really get into talking about the meat of this. They should also, in that section, talk about the context of their data in light of existing studies that confirm or refute the data that they're presenting. So what are other studies in the literature saying on this? How well do their results align with that? If they don't align, they should talk a little bit about why that might be. And then the last question that you want to ask yourself is just, in light of all these limitations and constraints and questions that you've managed to come up with in reading the study, what can you fairly conclude? And you can compare that to what the authors are actually stating, and you can kind of decide for yourself whether you agree with what the authors are stating, or maybe there's something that they missed. And it might not be something they missed. It might just be something they didn't have room to discuss in the paper because of a word count. You never know. But it's important to go that extra step and not just read the surface and take it at face value. Really take time to think about it for yourself.
And this is awesome. This is science, right? And it doesn't, yeah. This will be, so we, on the podcast, we go into studies and stuff, and I'm sure we've missed something, and please go in the forum. If we've missed something, tell us, like we need to hear it. But also
this stuff's really fun.
I know, but also like researchers, this is what they do with each other the whole time. When they're, and when it's in peer review, they say, oh, what about this? What about this? This is what Amber's job was to do that. And then after things get published, people go, what about this? What about this? And then it just evolves around. So the discussion and the, especially the analysis around details is extremely important, and it shouldn't be viewed as, it's not a critical thing. It's more of a questioning and evolve and a debate thing, rather than saying something bad about someone, as, because like we said, all studies have limitations and they need to be put in context of those limitations, which is, it's hard to do, right?
Yeah, it really takes a lot of work. This is hard to do. But this is actually what our podcast team does for every deep dive. And it takes a lot more effort to do this responsibly and with integrity than to just put it out there. And for us, this is so worth it because this is your hard work. We need to do our due diligence and do right by you.
Yes. So now, next step of this podcast, before we get into the research papers, we need to kind of frame polarized and what polarized training means. And this is difficult because in different spots and even different papers, it gets measured differently. And on the forum, there's in our own forum, there's a lot of discussion about what it actually means. So what we're going to try to do is tell you how different people have talked about it and try to get a common language for the rest of this podcast.
Right. This stuff does get really confusing. So in order to establish this common language and define some terms, we're going to talk first about endurance training in general. We're going to talk about how periodization fits into endurance training, periodization not to be confused with polarization. And then after we talk about periodization, we're going to talk about training intensity distribution. We'll kind of lay out how all of these things relate to one another, and that will help frame our conversation around polarized training. So let's get started with just a really basic definition of endurance training. We can boil this down to a very simple equation, which really is just stress and rest equals adaptation. That's it. You can also say this as overload plus recovery leads to supercompensation. But really, at the end of the day, when you're looking at those adaptations on the right side of the equation, what we're looking for is positive adaptations that make us stronger, faster, and better. If we look at the left side of the equation, that stress plus rest, the stress is that training stimulus that we need to make sufficient enough to trigger those adaptations. And it needs to be sufficient in terms of magnitude, but the other thing that's important about stress sometimes can be also novelty. So we are ever adapting systems, right? We talk about this all the time. And if there's one thing that's really clear in the scientific literature, it's that biological systems are highly adaptive. And so in order to trigger those adaptations, you need to have a sufficient magnitude of stress and also sometimes novelty. And then of course, the rest component of that equation is really, really important too. And that's just that we need to have sufficient rest relative to that stress in order to make sure that the adaptations remain positive.
And now a key point too, looking at Trainer Road, is we look for specific adaptations based on your goal type. And this is usually over a base build specialty cycle, where I'll give you an example. If you are doing a criterium, that's going to be a different adaptations that we're looking for than if you were doing a 40K time trial. That's just something to put in context as we get into more in the studies and too about what kind of outcome we're looking for. And there's not just one specific outcome in general that you want all cyclists to have.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So we've established endurance training. So within endurance training, we can kind of zoom in on that left side of the equation, if you will. But within endurance training is this concept of periodization, which is really how you organize and time the distribution of your stress and recovery. So this takes on, we've talked about adaptation on the right side. We're looking at the left side. Organizing the timing and distribution of stress and recovery is known as periodization. And the goal of periodization is really just to increase the odds of your success in meeting your goals. So let's say that you have a big goal event. Well, periodization would be organizing the stress and rest in your training plan so that we time your peak capacity and form to coincide with that goal event. Maybe your goal is just to increase fitness over time. Well, then we would want to periodize your training plan so that you can sustainably and healthfully increase fitness over time. And there's a bunch of different periodization models, which is just another way of saying there's a lot of ways you can organize the stress and rest in a training plan. And all of these models use different cycles and divisions. You can organize based on an annual basis. You can organize based on phase. You can do a weekly basis. But this is all just coming back to timing and distributing the stress and recovery. So periodization models that are out there, a common one is linear periodization, base build specialty. A lot of the Trainer Road plans do use linear periodization, not all of them. There's also reverse and inverted periodization where you start with specialty, move to build, and then go to base. There's block periodization where you focus on increasing a single energy system or power zone while you just maintain the others. There's also undulating, which is where you cycle through heavy, medium, or easy days, fractal, conjugate sequence. The periodization models go on and on. All of this is to say that periodization is that organization of the stress and rest, and there's a lot of ways that you can periodize a training plan. So zooming a little bit further in, We've talked about stress and rest and organizing that in terms of periodization. What if we just zoom in now on just the stress component? This is where we get to a concept called training intensity distribution. And this is specifically how we organize and distribute stress in our periodized training plan. So in context of periodization. So the way that we organize and think about stress is in terms of the duration of the stress and the intensity of the stress. And that's pretty straightforward. The duration is obviously how much time are you spending in a stressed state? And then the intensity is how stressed are you? So we can measure intensity. Well, duration, we obviously measure through time. And then intensity, we can measure in a variety of different ways. We can look at it in terms of energy system, power zone, pace, heart rate. And the way that you're going to measure the intensity depends largely on your discipline. But in cycling, we use power zones to measure the intensity level. Now, this is a really important point to understand, and this gets really confused, especially in conversations about polarized training. A training intensity distribution is not the same thing as a power zone. So a power zone is how we measure intensity. A training intensity distribution is how we organize intensity and duration to accomplish the stress component of the endurance training equation. So power zone, how we measure intensity. Training intensity distribution, how we organize intensity and duration. So for the discussion today, and again, we're just clarifying so that we're all using the same language for this conversation today, but we're going to be using what's known as a three-zone model. And that's because this aligns with the current definition of polarized training and with the current research on polarized training. And the three-zone model is set up essentially like this. Zone one is the easy or the low intensity zone, and that goes roughly from 50% of VO2 max up to your LT1 or your lactate threshold one. LT1 is the point at which we just start to see lactate accumulating in the blood. Then between LT1 and LT2, LT2 being your lactate threshold that most people are more familiar with, the lactate threshold 2 is where we see the rate of change, the rate of accumulation in your blood level. The rate of accumulation in your lactate in the blood start to increase. So it's really just a rate of change that we see at that lactate threshold. So between LT1 and LT2 is what's known as that moderate intensity zone 2. And then intensity levels above that lactate 2, LT2, is high intensity, and that's known as zone 3 in this zone 3 zone model. There's a quick note on this, and that's that some studies we'll use LT1 and LT2 as kind of those hinge points to define the borders between zone 1, zone 2, and zone 2, zone 3. Other studies will use VT1 and VT2, and those stand for your ventilatory threshold 1 and your ventilatory threshold 2. Ventilatory threshold 1 correlates really well with LT1. VT2 correlates pretty well with LT2, but there's some evidence to show that it correlates differently depending on what discipline you're in. So that's just something to keep in mind when we're talking about the studies. It's just a little grain of salt to keep perspective as we're looking at this.
Two, so that based on power, this is how Dr. Seiler has described it on podcast, is that Z3 is FTP and above. So 100% of FTP and above. Z2 is anywhere between 80% and 99%. And then Z1 is between 50 and 79. And now it's important to note, this is it's a window, not a switch. So mm-hmm. I don't think there's a specific, oh, I'm at 99, now I'm at 100, and it's a completely different training outcome. It's probably similar, but not that. And we did these LT tests and the VT tests, ventilatory threshold. That's like my kryptonite. Okay, I got it the second
you
time.
You got it.
But what we saw was for Chad and I, that 2 millimoles, that's where our endurance pace was around, I believe, 220 years ago. And then at our threshold, it was like 270, 275. And that's where it was at 4 millimoles. And then it started to go up really fast. Now, that is kind of the average with people. But we saw that John had very weird lactate tests where he was at like 18. We're going to call John an outlier in that. But the ventilatory thresholds, describe those. That's when you're normal breathing and you're in a workout. If you pay attention, you'll see this. It's the first step where you start to breathe like at a faster rate. And then at VT2, That's when you're doing like a pretty hard workout and it is the, you probably have all experienced this before. That's what that is. And this is a
sign where you can't have a conversation anymore.
Yeah. Right. You can kind of do it at VT, above VT1. And, this is where people half wheel you and talk to you, right? When you're in VT1, because they can know you can kind of talk, but it like, it's kind of hard. But what, so if you're Polar, Garmin, or Wahoo, and you're listening to this, what I want you to do is built into your heart rate monitors, a strain gauge, not a strain gauge. I forget what it's called, but it can tell, I want you to calculate when your chest is moving to try to then pinpoint these VT1 and VT2, and we can tie it back to power data. And this could then be fed into adaptive training and try to see what correlations we can have in the system. I mean, I'm a data geek, but I would easily pay 100 extra dollars for probably like a dollar sensor in there in order to have that happen. And I know. So anyways, side note, Amber, let's move on.
We get excited about this stuff if you can't tell. Okay, so we've established endurance training, stress plus rest is adaptation. Periodization is how we organize the stress plus the rest. And if we zoom in on the stress, how we organize just the stress component is your training intensity distribution. So when we talk about polarized training refers to a very specific intensity, training intensity distribution. And in this training intensity distribution approach, you spend by far the most time in that low zone, zone one under LT1. You spend some time in the high intensity zone, zone three above LT2. And you spend the least amount, if any, in that middle zone between LT1 and LT2. Dr. Steven Seiler, whom Nate just mentioned, is the first person. He coined the term polarized in a 2004 paper. I'm pretty sure this is where it landed, but this was a paper called Training and Performance Characteristics Among Norwegian International Rowers from 1970 to 2001. And what he observed in this retrospective study was that these elite athletes spent about 80% of the time of their training in low intensity zones in that zone one, and about 20% of the time in that high intensity zone, zone three. Now, it's really important to note that he based this observation based on a binary categorization of days. So a day was either high intensity or low intensity. So if he calculated this 80-20 ratio based on days, not time and zone. Now, this is really interesting because subsequent research that's looking at training intensity distributions and specifically looking at the polarized training intensity distribution bases the ratios that determine whether or not a training intensity distribution is polarized on time in zone. And that's obviously really different from days. And so when you translate days to time in zone, you start to get different ratios. And this is just an important thing to keep in mind, because again, this is one of those tricky things that can make talking about polarized training a little bit confusing and a little bit sticky.
Yeah, on our forum alone, there's probably 500 posts that just debate this, is the what days are hard versus the time and zone. But when we want to think about it, it's more of a principle, right? Mm-hmm. There is the hard days hard, easy days easy, and you're doing most of the hard days. And then in the science and literature that we're going to get into that talk about exactly the time and zone, that can still teach us something, right? But there's not, Seiler himself says it's more of a, what's the word I'm looking for? I just used it.
Guidelines
rather than like a specific training plan.
Mm-hmm. Right. So one of the things that we'll see with the studies that we're going to look at is some of them use what's called the polarization index to determine whether a particular training intensity distribution approach is polarized or not. And the polarization index is an equation that uses time in zone, not days, time in zone, in order to calculate what they refer to as a polarization index. And if that polarization index has a value of two or greater, it's considered a polarized training plan. We'll get into why that's a little bit gray. That's a little bit of a gray area, but that's just something to keep in mind. So a lot of these studies, in fact, the vast majority of them are looking at time and zone, but remember that that's different than basing the ratio on days. And this gets even more confusing because we say polarized capital P training intensity distribution or a polarized plan, capital P polarized plan. And that has a specific meaning, which is that is a plan. It's a specific definition as a polarized training approach. And this can differ based on which study you're reading, but this is different from polarized small p polarized in the sense that you can polarize your training. So if you just polarize your training, you're shifting emphasis more to that low zone intensity and more to the high zone intensity, and you're decreasing the amount of time that you're spending in that middle zone. So there's capital P, polarized, defining a particular training intensity distribution approach. And then there's small p, polarized, which can refer to the degree of polarization and either polarizing, you know, moving your training distribution into a more polarized direction. So trying to make this a little bit more clear, but this stuff is confusing, and we'll do our best to distinguish between capital P polarized and little p polarized. All right. So we have periodization. Now we've talked about training intensity distribution and polarized, but polarized is not the only approach to a training intensity distribution. So we actually see five main training intensity distribution approaches in the literature, and we'll see these in the studies that we're going to cover today. All training intensity distribution approaches are just different ratios of the same elements, stress categorized as low, moderate, or high intensity. It's important to note here that even the low intensity zone, zone one, is not the same as recovery. In this model, the low intensity zone is still a training stress. It's not the same as active recovery or rest, because those parts of your periodization would be part of that recovery component in the equation. So again, it can get a little bit confusing, but the low intensity zone is still considered part of the stress component of that equation because it is a training stress. Okay, so the three training intensity distribution approaches that focus on a single zone are long slow distance or high volume low intensity, high intensity interval training or HIIT, and threshold. So high volume low intensity, also known as LSD, which is long slow distance, focuses on that low intensity zone. And this requires pretty high volume in order to get enough of a training stimulus to stimulate those adaptations. High intensity interval training, or HIIT, you can imagine, is the opposite of that. This one focuses on that high intensity zone three zone. And of course, this is going to require a lot less volume to keep from overtraining. Between those two is what's called the threshold training intensity distribution. Now, this is again really confusing because there is also a threshold power zone and there's also a lactate threshold, but threshold as a training intensity distribution is an approach that focuses on that moderate intensity middle zone between LT1 and LT2. And now this is going to require more volume than the high intensity interval training because it's less intensity, so you need a little more volume, but it would require less volume than the long slow distance because you're doing more intensity.
Now this is, so I just want to jump in here.
Yeah.
Sorry, Amber.
Please do.
This is the 80% to 99% of threshold training. And it can be easy to say, to hear threshold training and think of like Coggins model and say, that means that's 95 to 105, which it's different. And then we just want to make sure that's very clear in people's minds. So when we refer to threshold training inside of a intensity distribution in these studies, we'll refer to it again as it's the between the LT1 and the LT2.
Right, exactly. And these three models, because they focus on a single intensity, they're a little bit limited in their application because we know that we're adaptive machines. And so if you're always focusing on one zone, chances are you're going to need to switch something up. You might need to increase the magnitude or the novelty of the stress because eventually you're going to plateau because your body's just really good at adapting to this stuff. How many people ready to hear me say bodies are amazing? There you go. All right. Now, I said there's five primary training intensity distribution approaches. So the other two are training intensity distribution approaches that incorporate multiple intensities. So one of those is polarized, which we've already just talked about. And that one focuses on that low zone and on the high zone, and really not much, if anything, in the middle. Then there's pyramidal. Pyramidal is a training intensity distribution that focuses most of your volume in that low intensity zone. The vast majority of volume is in that low intensity zone. Then you have some in that middle intensity zone, and you have a little bit in that high intensity zone. Thus the name pyramidal, right? We have big base, small middle, smaller top. Both of these training intensity distribution models include stress and recovery toward adaptation. That's going back to that equation. And they incorporate a little bit more variety than those single intensity focused approaches. So you'll notice in talking about those training intensity distribution approaches, I did not mention sweet spot training. So what about sweet spot training? Well, this is another thing that gets really sticky and confusing. Sweet spot is a very specific power zone. It is not a training intensity distribution. So it doesn't actually really make sense to compare a training intensity distribution an approach to training intensity distribution like polarized to a single training power zone. It's just apples and oranges. All right. So I'm just going to quickly review. We have our endurance training model. It's stress plus rest is adaptation. How you organize the stress and the rest in your training plan is periodization, zooming in on the stress. How you organize the stress, the intensity and duration of that stress is your training intensity distribution. We have five primary models of training intensity distribution. Three of them focus on a single zone. Those are LSD, HIIT, and threshold. And then two of those focus on multiple zones, and those are polarized and pyramidal. All right. All of this is to say...
You're making this easy on me. Please go.
Okay. All this is to say, the type, intensity, distribution, and duration of stress, these are all different tools at your disposal. And how you organize or periodize that stress with recovery over time is just another tool at your disposal. So it doesn't really make sense to ask, what is the optimal tool? Imagine you pull a few tools out of your toolbox. You design an experiment to determine which of these is the optimal tool. And based on your experiment, you decide this one is the best of five. Imagine then going to a carpenter and saying, I have found the optimal tool. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. It's kind of silly. And that's because a better question to ask would be, what is the right tool for the job? Now, if you ask a carpenter, what is the right tool for the job? He or she is probably, or they, is probably going to say, well, that depends on what stage of the process you're in, because you have different needs at different times. It's also going to depend on who's using the tool, because there are different needs for different levels of experience. And it's also going to depend on what's being built, because there's different needs for different outcomes and goals. So at Trainer Road, what we do is we want to give you a full toolbox. We want to educate and empower our athletes to apply multiple tools to align with their different goals, their different experience levels or fitness levels, their different stages of the process, whether that be career, season, or life. It's all about making sure that you have a full toolbox at your disposal so that at any given time you can find the right tool for you.
And it's one you didn't mention was time too. I think a lot of age group people were time limited, and that has just goes into the equation of what tool for when. And what we're really excited about is with adaptive training is what can we do to kind of give you a better option of what tool at the right time in sort of this huge picture of periodization for what your goals are too, if you're racing or if you're not racing in terms of cycling. It's very exciting for me. So I think now hopefully we have a common language to talk about these things. Now let's talk about the studies of polarized training.
Right. All right. Let's dive in. I hope you all brought a snorkel. All right. So one of the most commonly cited studies demonstrating the effectiveness of polarized training is probably the Neal et al. Study from 2013. This is also one of the few intervention studies that examines the effectiveness of specific training intensity distributions, polarized being one of them, in cycling specifically. So we'll spend a little bit more time on this one because of that. So the Neal et al. Paper, this is published in 2013. The title of the paper is 6 weeks of polarized training intensity distribution leads to a greater physiological and performance adaptations than a threshold model in trained cyclists. So again,
go ahead.
Dive in.
Okay. So what they're trying to figure out here is based a threshold model where you do a bunch of Z2 work and no Z3 work, does that improve performance or certain, we'll get into it, ways to measure how fit you are relative to following a polarized model? Now, the questions that we have that we're going to jump into are the importance of Z3, the possible effects of fatigue on testing outcomes, and the order of these blocks of the intensity. And that might sound a little esoteric right now when I say it, but we're going to go back and hit these as we go through the study. But just try to remember those as we go through it.
Exactly. Okay. So let's dive in. On this study, again, authors have to kind of choose, not kind of, they have to choose the subjects that they're going to use for the study. So in this case, they chose trained male cyclists, and they chose to define trained as cyclists who have been training for at least 4 years or more, 5 to 10 hours a week, and all of their subjects had peak power output of about 4.7 plus or minus 0.5 watts per kg. So in that range, that's going from about 4.2 to 4. or a little over 5 watts per kg at peak power output. Peak power output is somewhere around your VO2 max power, roughly. So what this does is it puts these cyclists at, they're going to range between the low and the high end of roughly a Cat 3 fitness. And they had 12 subjects for this study. And this is a really cool experimental design. I love this design. So it's a randomized crossover study. And what that means is they randomly chose subjects. They divided them into two groups. So because they had an N of 12, they divided them into two groups of 6 each. And the treatment went like this. They each group did 6 weeks, one of polarized, one of threshold, and then they tested. So they did baseline test, 6 weeks in one of those two training intensity distributions, and then they tested. Then they did 4 weeks of detraining where they did nothing over LT1 and they only rode 3 to 5 hours a week. After that, they did another baseline test and then they did 6 more weeks. This time, if they had done polarized the first time around, they did threshold. And if they'd done threshold the first time around, they did polarized. So that's what they mean by crossover study. And that kind of helps even out some of the individual variation that we see in this. And the way that they did this during those 6 weeks of polarized versus threshold, the polarized prescription training was fixed at 80% in that low intensity zone 1, 0% in that middle zone between LT1 and LT2, and 20% in that high intensity zone 3. The way they did the high intensity work was they did 6 by 4 minutes on and 2 minutes off at about 105 to 110% of LT2 or FTP. Versus the threshold group. The threshold group divided their training up into about 57% low intensity zone, 43% in that middle zone between LT1 and LT2, and 0% in that high intensity zone 3. And the way that they did their intervals was a 1 by 60 minute effort, continuous, at halfway between LT1 and LT2. And again, all of these percentages are based on time in zone. What they measured was,
So that to give context, halfway between LT1 and LT2 is probably somewhere around sweet spot. So in this one, in their method, they were given 60 minutes straight of a sweet spot or a little bit low, somewhere close to that. It doesn't directly relate, and we don't really know what they did exactly, but that's kind of some guidance on that.
Yeah, it just sounds very boring and uncomfortable. So what these researchers did is they studied physiological adaptations and performance outcomes. And I also love this about the study because we know that the physiological adaptations and biomarkers on that biochemical level don't always correlate perfectly well with performance outcomes. So it's important to look at both. So for the physiological adaptations, they looked at metabolomics, and that they did this by looking at muscle biopsy to get oxidation markers, any changes in those, and they also looked at urine. For performance outcomes, they looked at a 40K TT power output and a 40K TT time. They also looked at power at LT1 and LT2 and changes in the peak power output, as well as high intensity exercise capacity, which they measured as time to exhaustion at a continuous steady state of roughly 95% of the peak power output. All right. So what did they find? Well, let's look at the performance findings first. Pre and post training, both the polarized and the threshold groups saw significant improvements. So there was a significant improvement in the training interval power output, whether they were doing the threshold or the polarized intervals. They saw a significant increase in 40K TT power. So there's a significant increase in both. And there was no significant difference between the polarized and the threshold group. They saw an increase in high intensity exercise capacity for both, and it was significantly increased for both, but the polarized group actually increased that significantly more than threshold. And when I say significant, that's a statistical metric that's just saying that it's not likely that this is just due to chance.
So I want to say this.
Yeah.
Can I jump in here? This is very important to this outcome. So basically, they raised probably their VO2 max power with polarized statistically more than the threshold group. They raised their threshold more with the polarized group than the threshold group. But the 40K TT power was not significantly different, which is very interesting because you would think, well, how could that happen? And what probably happened is in the threshold group, that group doing mostly sweet spot, is they raised their ability to operate at a percentage of threshold for longer to get that same power, because the other group, Polarize, actually raised their VO2 max and their threshold. So in order for this to work, that's what happened. Another thing in here that I'm kind of curious of why they put this in the study, and maybe there's a great reason, but they said that there was a significant difference in time for the 40K TT, but not in average power. And now they did their 40K TT on a CompuTrainer. So the I know the way that works, it's an input of power and weight and all that sort of stuff. So if those other ones didn't change, the only input is power. And the only way to have a better outcome of a 40K time trial time is to pace better. But the power wasn't any different in the end. So just here, when you look at it, I think it stands to reason, based on this data, that if you don't have any Z3, you don't raise your threshold and your VO2 max as much as you did. The only two plans that we have that don't have Z3 would be the sweet spot based high volume 1 and 2. And again, that has context. We're going to talk about that, but that's just how this study relates to what we have done.
Those
Amber, you want to go from here?
Picked on. Yeah.
I know that they do.
All right. So let's look at what they found for the physiological markers too, because that's really interesting. They actually found that for neither group, for both groups, they saw no change in muscle oxidative markers, which is pretty interesting because we saw some significant changes in performance outcomes, but not the physiological adaptations. They did, however, see significantly higher MCT4, which this is an important biomarker that has implications for lactate shuttling. It was significantly higher for both groups, and there was no significant difference between groups. They really weren't sure if this was from training stimulus or timing a biopsy, so we're not going to dig too far into that. They suggested in the paper that this might just be because these are well-trained athletes and maybe they can't improve the oxidative capacity, but I'm a little dubious about that because a Cat 3 fitness level is very, very fit and very trained relative to somebody off the couch, but maybe not as trained relative to a professional level cyclist. So it's really hard to say, but the timing issue there may be part of what was going on. So let's look at some observations, and Nate already jumped into this a little bit, but based on the data presented, the authors concluded that the polarized approach was more effective, and that certainly seems to be true for some of the metrics that they looked at. The other thing that they said, and I'm going to quote from the paper here, the authors say, "Whereas we appreciate that trained athletes will incorporate all three intensity zones into their training schedules and competitions, our aim was to determine the impact of high-intensity interval work versus moderate-intensity continuous threshold training sessions on adaptation." So they know that all three are important. And then they say, "Since the absolute training volume at low-intensity zone one was closely matched between the groups, these differences in adaptation must come down to the training time spent in zone 2 or zone 3, with zone 3 proving more effective." Now, this is one of those moments where you don't have to be an expert in the field to just apply some simple logic. So they had one group that just did zone 1 and zone 2, and if we hold zone 1 equal, they were doing mostly zone 2. The other group was doing zone 1 and zone 3, holding zone 1 equal, they were doing just zone 3. So you could look at this as a comparison of zone 3 versus zone 2. That makes sense. So we can logically conclude that zone 2 only was not as effective as zone 3 only. But logical thing here, we can't rule out the scenario where no zone 3 was not as effective as some zone 3. Stated in a more positive way, some zone 3 is going to be way more effective than no zone 3, right? So we can't just conclude that zone 3 is better than zone 2 because we haven't ruled out that the zone 3 versus no zone 3 kind of logical conundrum here. So this is one of those moments where you definitely want to apply your own logic, because the authors themselves elsewhere in the paper state, and I quote, "Zone 3 is a critical component for promoting adaptation." So this is a really interesting, outstanding question. Not to say that the authors did a bad job or it's a poorly designed study. It's a really nicely designed study. It's quite elegant. But this is a really exciting, outstanding question that we can check out in future investigations.
Yeah. So I think it's great to know this too, that the zone 2 stuff did not raise the VO2 max as much as the zone 3 and the threshold. But again, PPU. Relating, sorry, PPU. Yeah.
It's okay.
Sorry. All these words, relating this stuff though, back to trainer road plans, the only two plans we have that are like this are the sweet spot based high volume. And, it gets confusing of why, you know, this plan is discussed so much when all of our plans besides those have Z3. We'll kind of get into that more later again. I'm kind of teasing later over and over again, but it's, I just want to hit that a lot of times so that people understand that Trainer Road is not a bunch of Z2 only training. We're a combination of Z2 and Z3 and a pyramidal approach for most of our clients.
And Nate already touched on this earlier, but since we're talking about our observations on the study, the interesting thing is that when the threshold group did not increase their peak power output, their higher exercise capacity, as we saw, but that kind of indicates that for that 40K TT power output, where there was no difference between the group, that the threshold group was probably operating at a higher percentage of their capacity. So we're not seeing the performance outcomes across the board, but we do see that that kind of hidden one that wasn't directly addressed. And this is really consistent with previous research, and it's actually consistent with our data at Trainer Road too. This is what we would expect if someone were doing a similar training block.
That's actually the goal of sweet spot based high volume, is to get people to operate at a higher percentage of their threshold. And then later on in the base and build, order to raise their threshold through other means. I misspoke earlier when I was talking about PPO performance. I called it VO2 max. It might have increased their VO2 max, but they did not measure that in here. And you can have power increase at VO2 max without raising your VO2 max. That's I just want to correct that for what I said.
Yeah, if in case you guys haven't noticed, we are deep in the weeds here, folks. We are deep. All right. So one other thing I want to mention about this experimental design. Like I said, I really love this. The randomized crossover, it's very elegant. But there's a couple of points in here that didn't get brought up in the paper that I find really interesting. Again, taking that one step further, not just reading and taking it at face value, but let's think really critically about this. So the authors closely matched zone one volume between the groups. So we'll just say zone one volume is pretty much equal. Then that meant that they had to, you know, the threshold group was focused on the moderate intensity, and then the polarized group was focused on the high intensity. So what ended up happening as a result of that is, in trying to keep the zone one match, the total volume and training load was significantly higher for the threshold group. Now, what the authors say is, notably, this outcome, the fact that they saw greater adaptations over 6 weeks in polarized than threshold, occurs despite a greater total training volume with a threshold training model, and occurs in already well-trained cyclists. So they're saying they're surprised that they didn't see more performance improvement outcomes in the threshold model since they were training more. Well, let's look at those numbers really quick. So keep in mind that the subjects have roughly a Cat 3 level of fitness, typical Cat 3 level of fitness. The polarized group was doing a TSS roughly of about 430 to 610 per week. Now, that's a pretty typical range for a Cat 3 cyclist, a highly trained Cat 3 cyclist. In the threshold group, they were doing between 515 to 750 per week. That's a big difference over 6 weeks. That's more of a Cat 1, 2 elite level of weekly TSS. So there is a huge difference, very significant difference in training load and volume. And the authors actually looked at this statistically. There's a statistical significant difference between the volume and training load of the two groups. Now, what the authors assume is that doing a higher volume and higher training load would lead to greater adaptations, but we know logically that total workload, thinking in terms of KJs, for example, can lead to fatigue too. And that with recovery following a fatiguing block, you might see a supercompensation. So it's possible, and we don't know this. We don't know because it wasn't investigated in the study, but this is a cool, outstanding question to be investigated. What we don't know is there is a possibility that that greater training load led to greater fatigue, which meant that the threshold group was testing in a more fatigued state than the polarized group. And this is supported by some of the metabolomics. They did detect some stress markers in the threshold training group and not in the polarized group. So this would be a really interesting question to drill down on later. So the outstanding question here is, would, if there were some rest before the testing, would that have changed the outcome? Would there have been as big of a difference between the two groups? Who knows? We don't know.
Wait, that point you just said is super important. Is that when they did these, they did not have any recovery week. They did the volume and tested right after that. Right. So the group that did the higher stress did not have a week of recovery. They just did higher stress and then tested right at the end of their block. And same thing with the other group with Polarized. They did their block, and then right at the end of the block, they tested rather than having recovery. And then after that, that's when they had the 4 weeks of low training. And this is where Amber said that possibly, we don't know, there could be some super compensation happening in that group. Then you switch to another training method, and the changes, they could be different. That's what I think. That's the interesting point, is they did not rest before they retested. So the group that had the more testing, to me, would be more fatigue going into a test.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting that the authors looked at that like, oh, more load would mean better adaptation. But we know that you need the rest between the load, because remember the equation, stress plus rest is adaptation. So that's a really interesting question. The other thing that is very related to that, is there the possibility of an order effect here? And this is a little bit mitigated by the fact that they had the 4 weeks of detraining before crossing over. But if you think about it, one group started out as threshold, which had that much, much higher workload. Then they rested for 4 weeks, and then they did polarized, which was a lower workload with higher intensity. That's kind of almost the structure of a taper. Granted, it would be a long one, and 4 weeks rest is quite a bit. But that seems like it would end up in a very different place than if you started with polarized in a very low workload, rested, and then moved into a much, much higher workload. And that higher workload is not just higher than what you would have done in the polarized group, but at that level of fitness, that higher level of workload is, like I said, that's more of a Cat 1, 2 elite level of workload for somebody who's at a Cat 3 level fitness. So that question of difference in workload is one, but then that also begs the question, is there an order effect? So would we have seen a different outcome if we had, having that overload and then recovery, would that have ended up doing something different? And that's more a question of the periodization and how the training intensity distribution falls into a broader periodization model.
And so we don't know the answers to those questions because the data wasn't, that was not shown in the data inside the study. But a little side note here is this is how we organize our plans. And we get the question a lot of why does specialty have less TSS than build or base? And we're going after this exact thing where as you get into specialty, we reduce the volume, we increase the intensity. And then as you get closer, there's even a rapid reduction in volume, and we keep the intensity high, and then that then peaks you for this event. So another interesting, as Amber said, these are interesting things. We still think it's a good study, but these are great questions that then be studied later in future studies to see if these things had any impact on it.
Right. And we're just applying all the tools that we talked about earlier and trying to analyze these studies, not just read them at face value, but really dig in and think about them. And we're spending a little bit of extra time on this study because it is one of the few specifically on cycling. So don't worry, we're not going to go this deep on every single one. But this is really, really interesting stuff. And one more thing I want to say about the study, because this is something that will come up in the other studies we talk about too, is all of the data in this study was shown in terms of averages. So they were looking at the mean plus or minus the standard deviation for the polarized group would be an N of six subjects. They looked at the mean and standard deviation. Same for the threshold group. And technically speaking, when you're looking at literature and you're doing statistical analysis, you should only ever display the data exclusively in terms of mean and standard deviation when the raw data, the individual data points, result in a normal distribution or what you would normally think of as a bell curve. And having a normal distribution or a bell curve, when you only have six subjects where we know that there's high individual variability, because that's just the nature of physiology, it's really, really unlikely that you're going to get a bell curve with just six subjects. So it would be really interesting to see the raw data. And when you only have an N of six or an N of 12, that's a pretty easy thing to display and show and talk about in a paper. Because we know that even one outlier in a group of six can really drag the mean up or down and affect statistical significance. I'm not saying that that's what happened here, but as a reader of this study, it would be super interesting to be able to see how this broke down on an individual level, and it wouldn't be too hard when you have such a small N.
Yeah. So again, these are just kind of questions. It doesn't invalidate the study at all.
No.
It's just interesting. And this is too a demonstration of what we go through when we go through deep dives about how we read these studies. Yeah. Okay. So the takeaways. One, I think let's say all the caveats we talked about aren't a big deal. And we can take away that polarized is more effective across a range of performance metrics versus threshold training, that's at Z2, somewhere between 80% and 100% FTP when you have zero Z3. So We also know too that the threshold only group was able to operate at a higher percentage capacity than Polarized, because Polarized raised their PPO and their threshold, but they had the same 40K average power. So this stands, the next thing in our investigation would be, well, Z3 is important, but how important is it? And also there's the one question about the questions on fatigue in there, but we can't really figure that out with any of the studies that we have on here. Okay, so now let's look at a study in runners. This is a Munoz, can't say his name right, can't talk, 2014 study that says, does polarized training improve performance in recreational runners? And this is the line here in the abstract is, runners who run the most polarized see the greatest improvement. But I think if we dive in the study a bit, it's less clear than that. Amber, can you take this away?
The central aim of this study was to quantify the impact of training intensity distribution on 10K performance in recreational athletes. So the researchers chose 30 recreational runners, again, deciding on the level of training. All of these folks did 8 weeks of common prep. So this was just to establish a nice clean baseline across all of the participants in the study. Then they did a 10K race to establish a performance baseline in the 10K, after which everybody did 10 weeks of training, and they split the group into two. So you either did polarized training for those 10 weeks or threshold training for those 10 weeks. Now, the prescriptions for the distribution in each of these groups was a little bit different than what they actually did. So what they actually did was, in the polarized group, it was about 73% zone one, 14% zone two, 13% zone three. For the threshold group, it turned out to be about 78% or 47% zone one, 37% zone two, and 16% zone three. After they did that 10 weeks in that training intensity distribution, they did another 10K race, and they measured the difference between the pre-training and the post-training 10K race to look at the different performance outcomes. What they found was there was actually no statistical difference between the polarized group and the threshold training group. Aha, but there's a catch. After whittling that group of 30 down to an N of six, they found a statistical difference. And the way that they did that was they looked at the athletes who had the most polarized training intensity distribution in terms of their actual training, and the most or least polarized, most threshold adhering training intensity distribution for the threshold athletes. So what those athletes did, the polarized group went from 73% zone one to 78% zone one, 14% zone two to 11% zone two, and 13% zone three to 11% zone three. So essentially, they decreased the percentage of time that they spent in zone two and zone three. Their zone two actually equaled zone three, and they spent most of the time in zone one. The other athletes in the threshold group that were part of this significant difference went from 47% zone one to 32% zone one, so a big decrease in zone one. They went from 30% zone two to 53% zone two, so a huge increase in zone two. Yeah, 37% zone two. They went from 37% to 53%, and then the zone three actually stayed the same. So what we see here actually is the most polarized group, really what just happened was they reduced the zone two and zone three time, and they increased their time in zone one. And the zone two and zone three were equal, which kind of is a good example of how the definition of polarized in the literature is pretty flexible, and it really changes a lot from study to study and even within a study. So what's interesting about this. Sorry. Oh yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
I was going to say that we're probably going to say the same thing, that most polarized in this context, you read the abstract, you're like, most polarized, that must mean it must be like 80-20 or something like that. They were actually Z2 and Z3 matched. They had the exact same. And then the N is pretty low at six people out of 30. And then they really changed that other threshold group. And in this study, when they say threshold, they did include Z3 work. So that's just something to think about, is that in this group, when they did those distributions for runners, and runners, there could be impact. There's other things in running with being a load bearing sport that could be adding to this, but Z2 and Z3 were the same, and that added a statistical difference in faster 10K race outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So should we check out this study on the Ironman?
Let's do it. Okay. So this next one, this is Munoz, again, the same author. Training intensity distribution during an Ironman season, relationship with competition performance. So this is a N equals nine. They started with 13, but four dropped out. All athletes completed similar training, adjusted for fitness and training status. Researchers calculated time and zone, again, time and zone, not days, and looked at correlation with race times. And what did they find? They found that the more Z2 time that they did in cycling led to slower race outcomes, even though most of their race was completed in Z2. So this is interesting. This is for these half Ironman athletes of 9 people, if they did more Z2, so more of that between 80 and 100%, they had lower race outcomes.
So I just want to make a quick distinction. You said half Ironman just a second ago, and I want to clarify, this was actually looking at Ironman competition. And the reason I'm clarifying that is we're about to look at a study on half Ironman. But I want to clarify really quickly that these authors didn't manipulate the training intensity distribution for this. They were just observing the athletes training in the buildup for their Ironman competition. And then what they did was they correlated the time spent in each zone in that buildup, and they correlated the time and zone with performance outcomes in the actual race, which is a really cool way of doing this. Because one of the hard things about these physiological studies is asking athletes to purposefully totally switch up their training program for a pretty long period of time. So this was a pretty elegant way of looking at this. And again, their key finding was that the more zone two they did in cycling, the slower the race outcomes. But this is actually a very different result from a study that we're about to look at that's investigating training intensity distribution in half Ironman athletes. So
this one is called Polarized and Pyramidal Training Intensity Distribution Relationship with a Half Ironman Distance Triathlon Competition. And this is Cels Perez et al. Of 2019.
Yeah, so this is,
and the central aim.
Oh, this is ahead, a really, really just recent take it, study. Yep.
The central aim was to relate time, training intensity distribution with performance during a half Ironman for polarized versus pyramidal training.
So in this study, they looked at 18 recreational male triathletes. Again, the authors had to decide whether they were going to do trained, untrained, elite, recreational. They chose recreational, and they defined recreational as athletes who had less than 2 years of experience previously with triathlon training. What they did was they had the polarized versus pyramidal group. Now, keep in mind, recall that the polarized and pyramidal methods of training intensity distribution are the two types of training intensity distribution that target multiple zones. So these are pretty similar. So the treatment had a polarized group that was doing 85% of their training in zone one, 4% in zone two, and 11% in zone three. The pyramidal group was doing 78% in zone one, 19% in zone two, and 3% in zone three. And again, these authors were calculating these percents based on time and zone, not based on days. So these athletes trained for 7 weeks. 7 of those were generic, so matched between groups, again, to kind of get everybody on the same even playing field before they look at the polarized versus pyramidal. Then they did 13 weeks of specialized training in each of those training intensity distributions, polarized versus pyramidal. They kept the volume and the training load the same for both groups, so not a confounding factor here. Zone one was roughly pretty equal between the groups, so getting rid of another confounding factor. They both included some zone three, so these were all limitations that, if you recall, we noted in the Neil paper earlier on. And importantly, because it's triathlon, they devoted the same percent of time to each discipline. So the polarized versus pyramidal group, they weren't spending more time on swimming, cycling, or running. They were evenly distributing the training time between those disciplines. The only difference in the training between the two groups was the polarization index. Now, we mentioned that these authors are using time and zone to determine the polarization. And this paper in particular used that polarization index that we used when we looked at all of the trainer road training plans earlier. And the goal of the training obviously was a half Ironman. They took physiological measurements and performance measurements to look at, again, the physiological adaptations, and the performance outcomes were obviously just to do with the race times in the half Ironman. What they found was that the polarized and the pyramidal improved across the board, but there was no significant difference between polarized versus pyramidal. So both groups improved significantly, but there was no real difference between them. And in fact, training time in zone two correlated with better performance in the recreational triathlete. So this is exactly opposite of what we saw in that Munoz study for the Ironman. And this is why it's important to read more than one study when you get into the literature and to really think critically about how they all compare. So the authors here conclude that moderate intensity, that LT1 to LT2 zone, is relevant and it should not be ruled out for long distance triathlons, and that that zone 2 might be more important for athletes with less training experience. So again, this is one of those big outstanding questions in all of this, which is how does training status affect how well a training intensity distribution is going to impact performance outcomes?
So far, kind of what we've seen is if you have pyramidal and polarized, the research suggests that they're pretty equal in terms of race outcome. It's interesting too, is a point on this about different populations, different training intensity distributions have different outcomes based on recreational versus not. And that is super interesting for us, especially with adaptive training, is how do you figure out these nuances of where you are in your training history about what will then make you the fastest cyclist, or in this term, triathlete, inside of your whole life context. And again, this is why this is so cool. These things always raise more questions than they answer. But hopefully there's a way that we can speed up this learning in the future. Okay. So now let's look at a meta-analysis.
Right. Okay. So we've seen there's conflicting evidence in the literature. We've seen there are different ways and flexible ways of defining what a polarized training intensity distribution is. So it's kind of a mess out here. There's some really promising trends. Obviously, polarized is a very promising training intensity distribution. But looking at a meta-analysis kind of helps us evaluate the literature in a more quantitative way. So Rosenblatt et al. Did this meta-analysis called Polarized versus Threshold Training Intensity Distribution on Endurance Sport Performance in a Systematic Review and Meta-analysis Randomized Controlled Trials. So when you do a meta-analysis or a systematic review, generally what you do is you set out some criteria with which studies that you're going to include need to meet those certain criteria in order to be included, because you can't be comparing apples to apples or apples to oranges. So what you're trying to do is get as close to comparing apples to apples as you can. But as we've seen, the studies in the literature can be really, really different. So you have to find some way of defining what an apple is in order to make those comparisons in a meta-analysis. So in this meta-analysis, they looked at hundreds of papers, and out of those, only 4 studies total qualified and met all the criteria for the systematic review, and only 3 of those studies actually qualified for the meta-analysis. Now, the meta-analysis is the part where they actually do the quantified analysis. So the 4 studies total, the Neil study is in there again. Of course, that's the first one we covered that had no zone 3 and had a few other shortcomings, but was really, really interesting, especially because it's a cycling-related and cycling-specific study. The Munoz study on the recreational runners was also included in there. And only 2 of the studies that were included in this were specific to cycling, and both of those studies had 0 zone 3 work. So the big takeaway from this one really is the fact that you could only find 4 studies total to include in the review and only 3 to include in the meta-analysis. In most other fields, if you got to that point, you would decide not to publish the paper. And not to say that this is not a valuable contribution. It certainly is. But what it does is it illustrates that there is a major scarcity of research in the literature right now, especially research that's consistent in methodology, that's consistent in the training status of the subjects, that's consistent in the definition even of what the polarized training intensity distribution is within the study. So it's there's just not a lot out there yet, which is exciting for us because this is a whole train of research that we get to follow and discover. And it's really exciting for the scientists because this is job security.
Yeah. So I just want to get a point that you said that's pretty important, because this meta is used to criticize Trina Road. Is one, it's using 2 studies that already use Trina Road to say like, oh, there's this vast research. But for the ones that are cycling only, there's no Z3 work, which mm-hmm. Trina Road, besides for sweet spot based high volume 1 to 2, we do Z3 work. We follow more of the pyramidal approach. And I probably have to say that like 3 more times because I see it on the internet all the time. And I want to make sure that we don't get branded in that way, that we are just Z2 work all the time, base build specialty Z2 work. And that's what we are. Okay. So now let's go into the next study. Hydrin, current scientific evidence for a polarized cardiovascular endurance training model.
This is a really nice review paper. And it, again, it does a nice review of sampling the current literature out there. And they're looking at multiple disciplines across multiple studies. Not going to go super deep on this one just for the sake of time, but I will share a direct quote from the paper in terms of one of the things that the authors concluded, which was despite only a handful of reported studies on polarized training model. So again, there's still a scarcity of research. This research is still emerging. And a limited understanding of the key physiological changes. This is one of the key outstanding questions in all of this, is there's still not agreement on what are the best data to evaluate the effectiveness of certain training intensity distributions. Outstanding question. So despite only a handful of reported studies on polarized training models and a limited understanding of the key physiological changes, the polarized training model is promising for cardiovascular and muscular endurance exercise prescription. Absolutely. And that's one of the things that we're seeing consistently in these studies is the polarized training intensity distribution is definitely promising, and it's definitely showing a lot of efficacy. But to say that it's optimal, when we have so much, there's still so much conflicting evidence, and there's just not that much research yet. We can't get there just yet.
Yeah, and this is why we're adding polarized plans to Trainer Road to figure out what is optimal, not just for everybody as a blanket, but for you individually at what time of year, for what your goals are and all that sort of stuff. Okay,
right.
Next. And go ahead.
Oh, I just want to make one point on that. We're doing this as an experimental plan. So we're not going to just throw a new plan into our training system when we don't know enough about how effective it is. But we do understand that some of our athletes really like to experiment on themselves and see if something different might work. So we want to give them the opportunity to self-experiment and see how this goes. And in the process of doing that, we'll get this valuable data that we'll be able to see and start answering some of these questions.
Great. So let's now go on to the next one. This is Seiler 2007, Autonomic Recovery After Exercise in Trained Athletes. And this paper has been used to criticize Trainer Road for intensity distribution inside of a plan. Now, this is a super interesting paper. What Seiler was doing was measuring how long HRV, heart rate variability, takes to return to baseline after workout. So what HRV is that is measuring the time between the beats of your heart rate, and then how variable that is. So something that has a low variability would be like marching band, right? It's like boop, boop, boop. Something with a high variability would be you're kind of off the beat. It changes a lot. And what Seiler was showing in this paper is you have a baseline of higher variability, and then they work out that variability goes lower. And then how long does it take to return to the previous baseline? Yes, Amber.
It's only the two of us, but I'm still going to raise my hand. So one thing that's important to note here is what HRV actually measures. It's not just the variability in your heart rate, but the variability in your heart rate is a proxy for understanding how well in balance your autonomic nervous system is. So how well balanced are your sympathetic and your parasympathetic systems? So the more stressed you are, that's going to change your heart rate variability. And the more recovered you are, theoretically, that will also change your heart rate variability. I just wanted to make that clear. So it's not just the difference in how variable it is, but that why that's a proxy for recovery specifically.
Yeah. And this is something we've mentioned the last time in the podcast is we'd like to pull in HRV and then try to have ML correlate it between different performance and qualitative measures that you put into the system. Because there's this is kind of like polarized. There's debate about when you should take HRV in the middle of the night or in the morning and how you then should use that. It's not 100% this is the way to do it. So what Seiler found that in this study is that for elite athletes, both Z2 or Z3 work took about 30 minutes to get back. I'm sorry, not elite, highly trained athletes. These are highly trained runners, about 15 hours per week. And so a Z2 workout and a Z3 workout, it both took 30 minutes to get back to that baseline. But in in less trained, it was about 90 minutes. And this is super interesting. This has no context into training intensity in a plan and recovery long-term. This is just talking about this specific HRV when it returns to baseline. And although that doesn't mean that there's not a correlation between this and I was thinking about this, if we could get our athletes to do it, but I highly doubt we could get recreational athletes to sit in a chair for 90 minutes after every workout and see how long it takes to get back to it. That's kind of the stuff that in the lab, it might be good, but out of lab would not be good to try to measure that HRV. But we've got some other ideas. And as they get into the system, we will totally announce it and let you know. Anything else on this one?
No, let's do it.
Okay, next one, Larson, 2010. Training for intense exercise performance, high intensity or high volume. What Larson says is if training does not have a blend of both high intensity and high volume, high volume training inserts into the program, performance ability can stagnate. Absolutely. This is another one that's used to criticize Trainer Road, but we absolutely agree with this, that at some point, if you don't have high volume and some intensity, you're going to stagnate. And actually, I think we all know this, but everyone's going to stagnate at some point. You can't just get there with only volume or only intensity. It's a blend between both. Now, the question is that we want to figure out is how much intensity and how much volume. This is the key. Like we keep going out, right? What is the distribution for you? And also this distribution of small intensity and volume, is it different between someone who's doing 20 hours per week and someone doing 3.5 hours per week? And this is another reason why we're going to have these polarized plans where we'll keep that distribution steady at that low 3.5 hours a week and see what happens.
Yeah. And just a quick note, I'm no spring chicken. In my very, very early exercise physiology class, this was the classic question that was being posed as the eternal question of intensity versus volume. And this is a question that has really been a wonderful point of exploration in the science for a really, really long time. And there's a good reason for it. Biology is complicated, but it's really cool and it's really fun. We get to dive in and learn more.
Okay, next one. Seiler 2010. What is the best practice for training intensity and duration distribution in endurance athletes? And so what this study was, is it was a description of what elite athletes do. And this is the key line. For an athlete training 10 to 14 times per week, this means that 2 to 3 of these sessions would be threshold or high intensity training bouts. And then at elites with this volume, more high intensity training does not make them any faster and might overtrain them. So this is super interesting too. What Seiler saw is that 10 to 14 times per week, I bet you there's not a single person listening to this that trains 10 to 14 times per week, but this is because we're cycling and that's not normal in cycling, but this is a ton. And if in that context of 10 to 14 times per week, you can only handle 2 to 3 intense sessions. If you do another session and keep all those other volume sessions, it tends to overtrain someone. Now the question is, if let's say you have these elite people and they're training 4 to 10 times per week, what if they did 11 less sessions and added one sweet spot session? Would this ratio still hold true? Stands to reason that it would not. Like you would be able to drop 11 sessions and have one sweet spot station. But again, we'll look at this and see if this carries to lower volumes, if not. So That's one of these. Again, you have to think of it in context. If they're training 14 times per week, they can't do more than 3 sessions. But if you're training 4 times per week, can you do 4 sessions? Especially if not all sessions have the same recovery, if you're doing a little less. And we're going to cover that in a little bit.
Right. And then it's not just can you, but should you? And so there's so many questions we still have yet to answer. It's going to be awesome.
Exactly. Okay, this last one.
Right. So this was a systematic review by Keneally et al. The effect of periodization and training intensity distribution on middle and long distance running performance. Now, we've already brought up the question of like how well can we translate results from one discipline to another? Still an outstanding question. This one we're not going to spend too much time on just for the sake of time, but feel free to read it yourself. But the main takeaway from this review, and again, it's a review, so they were going through all of the studies that they could find in the literature that aligned with a particular set of criteria. So they were looking exclusively at runners. But what they found was a pyramidal and a polarized training intensity distribution approach. Both of those were superior to threshold training, which is the training intensity distribution approach. So threshold training is being used here as the training intensity distribution, and that's the one that focuses almost focuses primarily on zone two, whereas pyramidal and polarized are those training intensity distributions that focus on multiple zones. So in this case, what he found in the literature on running was that pyramidal and polarized were superior to threshold training, but there was no distinction between pyramidal and polarized.
So, okay, we've gone through all the studies now, and hopefully you're not all asleep. Some people, it's like the next day, they're like rewinding. So what can we fairly conclude from the research? Like, should I be changing all of our plans, right? Like right now.
Right. And this is the question that you want to ask yourself every time you read a study and every time you read multiple studies, given all of the limitations and the caveats and the confounding factors, what can we fairly conclude? So here's what I think that we can conclude from what we've just talked about. Polarized can be effective, absolutely, but we can't responsibly conclude that it is optimal. The research is still really unclear on many things. So one of the things we mentioned, what data are the best foundation for quantifying effectiveness of different training intensity distributions? Because every study was looking at different data to quantify performance outcomes or physiological adaptations, and we still don't know what's the best metric. There are other possible training intensity distribution models out there. There are only 5 major ones that we see in the literature, but you can imagine that there's a lot of ways to move these levers around and create other intensity distributions that have not been investigated. We'd like to see the effect of training intensity distribution in combination with different periodization models. Remember that training intensity distribution is at this very granular level, and it exists within the larger periodization of an entire training plan. So that's another outstanding question. What about the effect of novelty? So if an athlete is switching from one long-term stressor, like if they've been doing threshold model training intensity distribution forever, and then they decide suddenly to switch to polarized, is the novelty of that switch in stress, is that enough to elicit some new positive adaptations? What's the best way to periodize a training intensity distribution over longer time horizons? Because long-term effects have yet to be investigated. Do different disciplines benefit from different training intensity distributions? One of the things that's been noted that we haven't mentioned yet in the literature is, especially for disciplines that have high eccentric forces or high force impacts that sustain a lot of muscle damage, like running, would those be different and benefit from different training intensity distributions than, say, a low impact sport like cycling or swimming or rowing? So sport, training status, goals, timing, all of these things are things that can play into why or how effective a training intensity distribution is for somebody. And so these aren't just questions that we raise today out of thin air. These are questions that other researchers have pointed out as really exciting avenues for potential future research. We'd like to direct you to a really nice review by Stogel et al. In 2015 that raises a lot of these questions as well.
All right, this is why we're also very excited and why we built Adaptive Training. There's a lot of nuance in the research, and we hope to like kind of tease that out with machine learning. And just again, to give everyone expectations on this, these will always be steps towards a theoretical optimal, although optimal is probably never going to be achieved, at least in our lifetime, without some real crazy singularity or something like that. But one thing, I have some announcements, okay? First announcement. We've been working on additional TrainerO training plans that sit between the low and mid and high volume. That's one thing we can improve on, is giving people better choices, or not better choices, but smaller steps between volume levels to better suit them. So I don't have a date on when those are going to be out, but the team is working on them now. Second one, we announced this last week, but we are adding polarized training plans. These are going to be targeted to come out the week of March 15th. So very soon, you might already be March 15th by the time you're listening to this. We'll trade out any block with the polarized block. So you could switch out general build or specialty or sweet spot based 1 or 2 with the polarized block. And we're going to have them in many different volume levels. And this is all, we're going to try to adhere to that 90-10 time and zone distribution, or 80-20, depending on the plan. We'll also, right, so, go ahead, Amber.
Oh, sorry. Just to clarify, going back to what we talked about earlier, these are going to be more small p, so more polarized in degree, more small p polarized than our current plans, in order to be big p polarized plans. And again, like, this is going to be something that's an option for our athletes to experiment with, and that'll help give us more data, and we can dive in and see what it says.
What it's going to do is give us a very clear signal in our data about having polarized it and feed into machine learning and FTP prediction to figure out what, you know, what will happen. This is also going to be enabled under early access. So you have to turn it on the website, and there's a feature under profile called early access, and you can see that there.
If you have any questions about that, just reach out to our support team. They are amazing. They're so good at this stuff.
Another announcement with adaptive training is we are going to be launching levels. So this is the levels of and workout profiles for all workouts. The progression chart won't be there yet, but this is something that has been in beta that we think now can be released to everyone. And we've talked about that, of doing a stepped release to everybody. So that's really cool. And that's going to come out of the week of March 15th also, as long as we don't hit any snafus. Next thing we want to talk about is, actually, let's go into sweet spot base, because we did not talk about sweet spot base high volume 1 and 2 enough. Well, we alluded to it, that it's very different than the other plans, but we teased that we're going to talk about it, and now it's time to do that. So sweet spot base high volume is designed for a very specific subset of people. These are for high level athletes that can't get enough volume to stimulate adaptations at their current volume. So they might require 15, 20 hours per week of aerobic riding, although with their lifestyle, they just can't do it. And what we were trying to do is you raise the intensity a little bit, but reduce the volume in order to get similar, but not the same adaptations for people that don't have time. And now this not only works, this is only for 7% of our athletes. Because 7% of our athletes go through sweet spot based high volume, are compliant, and go on to raise their FTP. And that doesn't mean that 80% attempt it and something like that. I'm just saying that it's probably not for you, and you should not take on the challenge of sweet spot based high volume unless you are have gone through mid volume, low volume, and you're having a plateau. Again, a very, very specific type of rider. And this plan often gets used as criticism against Trina Road. People call it too intense, which we know it's not based on our data, that people can go through it, but it might be too intense for you. This is the thing where if I were to do Amber's pro training plan, it would be too intense for me. I just could not do it. But that does not mean that it was a bad plan. It just means it wasn't meant for me, which is very, let's always keep that in mind when we look at certain data.
Right. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry. Were you done? Because otherwise I'll jump in.
I'm done.
You're done. All right. I'm going to jump in then. So like Nate said, the goal for high volume sweet spot base is really to accomplish what we saw in the Neil paper, that Neil et al. Paper that we led our deep dive with. And that is to be able to build your capacity to work at a high percentage of your FTP. It's not necessarily going to increase your FTP or make your FTP really high, but it's going to enable you to work at a very high percentage of it. And the real key with this particular block is the periodization. And recall that periodization is how we organize the stress and rest in a training plan over the course of the whole training plan. So not just the one block, but we're looking ahead to what's this going to do for you 2-3 blocks down the road? What's this going to do for you in terms of timing your peak form with your event? So periodization here is key, because this block can prepare you for more small P polarized blocks like build and specialty. So build, as compared to sweet spot base, is more small p polarized, and specialty compared to build is more small p polarized. So this is really about preparing you for future blocks and making sure that we time that peak in capacity with a goal event if that's what you're looking for. So this is a really good example of why training intensity distribution in a single block is not the whole story. We have to consider periodization over a longer time course. We have to consider long-term versus short-term goals.
Okay, let's move on now to some more fun stuff. Adaptive training beta update. I've read on the forum stuff. A lot of people would like more specifics about how fast is this beta going to roll out, who exactly is in it, and what's happening. So I'm going to try to do that right now. We just added another 50 people to the beta, and we have a total of 130 people in it today. I know that does not sound like much. And what we do is It's not on a timeline. It's on a gate of confusion, bugs, and performance. So if there's a critical confusion, a critical bug, or a critical performance issue, we don't release to the next group. We try to fix it. And then we release it to that same group. If we have fixed the confusion, bugs, or performance critical issue, and then we go to the next group. And then it keeps getting bigger and bigger. What we've seen in past betas, they will start small like this, and then there'll be days where we open 500, 1,000, 2,000 people at a time as we get more confident in order to get that. Because we're not going to just do 50 a person a week. That'll go too slow. So it's almost like exponential, but it's not exponential. So that's what I just want to set everyone up, and trust us. There's nobody wants it out more than probably in the whole world, me. I really, really, really want this stuff out. And I also don't want it out unless it's ready for everyone. If we released it to, I don't know, 30,000 people tomorrow and there was a performance issue, we just have to take it back. And nobody wants that. The final announcement that I want to talk about is that we are working with real-world academic researchers inside of for adaptive training. One is we're developing a team to help ML model the features, so build the features of having somebody else from the outside who's in the research every day to give us ideas for more features we could build. The team then generates those and we see if that improves the model. So we are doing that. Also, we are working with academic researchers to help incorporate menstrual cycle tracking into the product, which is super duper cool. But side note, can you imagine if I had a period, how much I would talk about my period on the podcast, like flow state, cramping? It would be like, I would engineer the crap out of that. So let's normalize talking about periods for men talking about it. Cause I think that's why women don't talk about it, is cause men have a bad aversion to it. And women, if you see a man talking about it, please correct them if they're wrong, but let's encourage men that they can talk about it. Well, I'm sure we'll say some silly things, but just correct us when we do it, please.
I am just imagining Nate describing his menstrual cycle difference between sea level and at altitude.
Yeah, you'd be like, my flow at like sea level was like kind of bad. So then I was taking this product and all this. It would be insane, right? Oh, and I don't know. Yeah. It's been just a culture thing that we should fix, and very excited about that. And then finally, this is for the Science of Getting Faster podcast, where we talk to researchers directly. We're actually also with some nutrition research. After COVID's over, we're kind of slated, or I've committed dollars into researchers to fund some studies about what kind of nutrition product, some studies about nutrition inside of cycling. And I don't want to say anything yet because the studies aren't completely designed, but that's something else we want to do to kind of push forward the sport forward.
Right. We're just really excited to partner with academic researchers on this, because we do have some great data sets that they can benefit from, and then we can obviously benefit from their input as well. So hopefully, after all of this today, we have helped you more clearly understand polarized training, how training intensity distribution approaches fit into the bigger picture of periodization, how periodization fits into the bigger picture of endurance training, and how we incorporate all of these tools in our training plans here at Trainer Road. So remember, there is no such thing as the optimal tool. And we hope that your big takeaways from this is that whenever you come across something in popular media or even in the literature, really take that extra step to think critically about what it is that you're reading.
Great. So Nat, we'll be back next week with a regular podcast. Until then, train hard. I don't know. That was a bad sign off. Have fun. Live life. Carpe diem, everyone. You have anything good to say, Amber?
Have a great day, everyone.
Okay, have a great day. Bye-bye.